This is Functional Medicine Update for October 2001, Volume 21, Number 10. This month on Side 1, our topics will include changes in managed care, the human genome and personalized medicine, statin drugs, diabetes, and we will ask, how do you see the patient? Our clinician interview on Side 2 is with Dr. Richard Shamus, author of Thyroid Power, 10 Steps to Total Health. We complete this issue with a report on thyroid treatment for women in estrogen therapy. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the October 2001 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for October 2001, a month where we're going to focus on our continuing theme of the promotion of healthy aging, or I guess the default counterpoint of that is prevention of premature diseases of aging that are associated with the proper application of functional medicine. You might recall 5 years ago in Functional Medicine Update, I predicted that we would see this epiphenomenon called managed care come and go, with an obituary being written to its demise sometime in the near future. I think we can hail that date of the obituary was that of the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 285, page 2622 in the year 2001, an article by Dr. James Robinson from the School of Public Health, University of California in Berkeley, entitled The End of Managed Care. Dr. Robinson says, the protagonists of managed care are now in full retreat. As we know, they are broadening physician panels, removing restrictions, and reverting to fee-for-service payments. Government entities are avoiding politically volatile initiatives to balance limited resources and unlimited expectations. By default, if not by design, the consumer is emerging as the locus of priority, setting the priorities in healthcare. The shift to consumerism is driven by a widespread skepticism of governmental, corporate, and professional dominance. Unprecedented economic prosperity that reduces social tolerance for interference with individual autonomy in the healthcare system, and the internet technology revolution, which broadens access to information that was previously held by a select few and facilitates the mass customization of insurance and personalized medicine. Well, that's a very interesting quote from this issue of JAMA that may signal another sign of the change in our 21st century medicine. If we couple that together with the fact that as we have seen an inflationary spiral of costs in the healthcare system over the last 10 years, we have seen a super inflationary spiral of the increasing costs of medications. Medications which are now being demonstrated to have maybe a very significant question about their cost effectiveness, the ratio of benefit to risk. I now quote from a recent article that appeared in a series of medical consumer magazines entitled Poison Pills? The Food and Drug Administration Pulling Popular Prescription Drugs. This particular article that talks about the poisoned prescriptions, these new medications, these new drugs, is quite interesting. It goes on to give a couple of case histories of patients who had adverse responses, in a couple of cases lethal responses, to medications that had been approved. And as we talk about why this occurs, it's very interesting. It's the nature of today's system, says Dr. Raymond Woolsey, a leading expert on drug safety. With the advent of direct-to-consumer advertising, doctors are now under rising pressure to satisfy their patients' demands besides just treat the legitimate concerns, explains this professor and chair of pharmacology at Georgetown University Medical School. It is inescapable, since they would otherwise lose their patients if they don't prescribe these new drugs, and often they don't look adequately at the benefit to risk. While all medications have side effects, both known and unknown, experts say a specific case can be made against these new medications. They're the ones who are supposed to have higher value and to prevent consumers from taking unnecessary risks. However, we're starting to see risk develop to the system as a consequence of the push by direct-to-consumer advertising of the consumer to demand a specific medication and the physician wanting to support their patient, providing it without a clear understanding of some of the risks and benefits. Consumer compliance is crumbling. The prices are increasing. We've seen a more than doubling of the price of prescription medication as a percent of the total dollar spent on healthcare now going for medications. And as we look to the future, since 1997, The FDA has withdrawn about 11 popular prescription drugs, five of which were on the market for only a year or so when they were removed. Critics of the federal agency say it's because the FDA is approving new drugs too quickly, and in part the federal agency agrees. Therefore, what we're starting to see are things like Resulin, this wonder drug, this peroxisome proliferated activated receptor agonist drug that was being used as an adjunctive medication for the management of diabetes, type 2 diabetes, recently pulled from the market, and the drug's manufacturer, Park Davis Warner Lambert, agreeing to the FDA's request to have this drug removed because of potential liver toxicity. Recent articles then go on to talk about the risk that was known to this drug, and therefore it was an economic pressure to put it out in the market, even when it was probably a medication that was not needed, because the existing medications were able to manage the type 2 diabetic patient, and that this provided no significant benefit over existing medications and added an additional potential health risk. I'm now quoting from a recent article on risk to these thiazolidinediones or glithazone drugs. There's a wonderful review of this, Lessons from the Glithazones, a story of drug development that appeared in Lancet, authored by Dr. Edwin Gale. This is volume 357, page 1807 in 2001, that I think is quite illuminating in that it talks about how drugs get to market. The rise of modern medicine has largely been based upon the new drugs, and most of us can expect to hobble to our graves on the crutch of polypharmacy, says this article. Valuable and necessary though it is, drug development is expensive and wasteful. The process has developed into an evolutionary struggle between manufacturers who wish to maximize sales and profits and regulators who wish to ensure that new agents are safe and effective. It goes on to talk then specifically about the glithazone, the Resulin issue, and ask how did the troglithazone actually end up on the market? What was the clinical data that was compelling enough to approve this drug with the known potential effects on hepatotoxicity? If you look at this article carefully, it's very interesting. It shows the data of effects of the triglyphosone versus previous drugs that are on the market on hemoglobin A1C and on fasting plasma glucose levels in type 2 diabetics. And it doesn't take a biostatistician to see that, in fact, there is very little improvement in clinical efficacy. And in fact, in some patients, there is actually a decrease in their ability to manage blood sugar effectively on the triglyphosone medication over previous drugs with lower potential toxicity. So I think that we are in a very interesting period of reevaluation of the cost effectiveness of the medicine that we're providing. In Australia recently, when I visited, I saw an article that was on the headlines of the major newspaper, The Australian, that was entitled "The Pill That Could Break Medicare," talking about Celebrex, which seemed like a godsend for those with arthritis, but now it could break the Medicare bank because insurance reimbursement by the government for this one medication due to the prevalence of osteoarthritis was so great that it was actually causing the financial system to come down just by the reimbursement for this one medication, which was approved on the formulary. And then, of course, we see Pharmacia, the company that is the marketer of Celebrex in the United States, recently providing in the April of 2001 issue a regulatory letter to their healthcare providers in which they said that this letter is being sent to you at the request of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The FDA's Division of Drug Marketing, Advertising, and Communications has notified Pharmacia Corporation that it considered audio conferences concerning Celebrex given on behalf of G.D. Searle and Company, now a subsidiary of Pharmacia, as well as other promotional statements and actions by or on behalf of Pharmacia to be false or misleading and therefore in violation of the FDA Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. They go on to say, therefore, the FDA has requested that we correct these promotional messages accordingly, and in post-marketing experience, bleeding events have been reported in patients taking Celebrex predominantly in the elderly. Therefore, anticoagulation therapy increases the risk, and one should be very cautious with people on, say, warfarin taking Celebrex. They also go on to say serious gastrointestinal toxicity, such as bleeding, ulceration, or perforation of the stomach, small intestine, or large intestine, can occur at any time with or without warning symptoms in patients treated with NSAIDs, including Celebrex. They go on to say Celebrex is contraindicated in patients who have demonstrated allergic-type reactions to sulfonamides. Lastly, Celebrex is contraindicated in patients who have experienced asthma, urticaria, or allergic-type reactions after taking aspirin or other NSAIDs. This is probably different than the takeaway that most consumers who have seen the direct-to-consumer advertisements for Celebrex or other selective COX-2 inhibitors have about the safety and effectiveness of these medications. And how does that contrast to what was considered to be the anecdotal, non-scientifically supportable claim that a natural substance, glucosamine sulfate, could be used for not only reduction of the pain of osteoarthritis, but also to promote joint healing? And as you know, we talked about this in a recent issue of Functional Medicine Update, in which there were two very interesting papers published. One is the clinical trial that appeared in The Lancet on volume 357, page 251 in the year 2001, which was long-term effects of glucosamine sulfate on osteoarthritis progression, this randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial on patients taking 1,500 milligrams of glucosamine sulfate orally a day versus a placebo for 3 years, showing not only reduction of pain and tenderness, but also healing, which you don't get with selective COX-2 inhibitors of the osteoarthritically stricken joint. We also saw an interesting paper that appeared in Arthritis and Rheumatism talking about the mechanism by which glucosamine sulfate might have its impact. This is volume 44, page 1089, the year 2001, in which it was shown that there's preferential incorporation of glucosamine into the galactosamine moieties of chondroitin sulfates and articular cartilage explants when glucosamine is given as a conditionally essential substance or nutrient in these in vitro experiments, indicating that it may be necessary for repletion of proper chondroitin composition and synthesis, a joint-based lubricant. And we see then in The Lancet a variety of very interesting letters to the editor that appeared in response to the original clinical trial report. This is volume 357, page 1617 in 2001, again, with various opinions that are given in support for the benefit that glucosamine sulfate has on collagenous growth, even on keratin protein-rich tissues like fingernails and toenails, supporting then this as a both remediation of discomfort preparation and also a substance to help promote healing. So we're starting to see a swing of the pendulum, even with regard to conditions like irritable bowel syndrome. As you know, the New England Journal of Medicine recently had a very interesting review on irritable bowel syndrome. This is New England Journal of Medicine, volume 344, page 1846 in 2001, in which they talk about the fact that irritable bowel syndrome accounts for an estimated $8 billion annually in direct medical costs and $25 billion in indirect costs due to absenteeism and other problems that cause work loss on an annual basis. They go on to say that there are three components of the etiology of IBS, and those are visceral hypersensitivity, altered motility, and psychological factors that influence neurotransmitter balances. Infection has an effect, inflammation has an effect, and they then talk about the compelling evidence that inflammation of the enteric mucosa or neural plexus initiates or contributes to symptoms associated with irritable bowel syndrome, and the mucosal inflammatory cytokines may activate peripheral sensitization or hypermotility with messenger molecules such as TNF-alpha and interleukin-1 being messengers of inflammation. We know that there are three basic types of IBS. There is the pain predominant, the diarrhea predominant, and the constipation predominant forms. You might recall that the drug Lotrinex was recently marketed to manage what was considered the most prominent form, which is the diarrheal form of IBS. With great fanfare, it was released. Wall Street Journal articles touted how this was going to fill the gap necessary in the pharmacopoeia that would then generate a $1 billion new drug. And it's interesting when you look at the New England Journal of Medicine review article, because the symptom-guided treatment of irritable bowel syndrome for all three forms, that's the pain predominant, the diarrhea predominant, and the constipation predominant form of IBS, the number one thing is change in diet. How do you then relate a diet to an inflammatory process in the GI mucosa? And of course, that has to do with understanding the complex environment that we describe functionally of the gut flora, the gut contents, the transit time, the gut antigen load. All of these things play a very important role in the functional determinants of IBS in genetically sensitive individuals. But yet the way that this was approached with the medication Lotrinex was to try to affect the selective serotonin pathways in the gut mucosa and alter then motility by changing the vasomotor tone through the alteration of these transmitter molecules. The history, of course, is quite clear. Lotrinex didn't stay on the market very long as a consequence of some fairly severe problems with regard to constipation and some apparent very severe outcomes in patients. GlaxoWalcom then, on the request of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, announced that it would voluntarily withdraw this prescription medication, Elestrone or Lotrinex, for the treatment of women with a diarrheal predominant form of irritable bowel syndrome. The company disagreed with the FDA's assessment of safety, but would cease distribution, they went on to say. This is a consequence of a number of very severe problems that occurred by modifying with a medication the chemical communication systems of the gut, rather than possibly looking at the way that other variables in the environment, diet, commensal, enteric bacteria, influence the messaging system. So again, I think there are some very significant questions being raised as we move into the transition of 2001 about what will the future of medicine be. Will it be more functionally based, or will it be more pharmacologically based? That is, I think, opening the screen, opening the curtain for the dawn of our new era of personalized medicine, what Dr. Linus Pauling called molecular medicine, what some called genomic medicine. I think the article by Dr. David Baltimore in the Nature magazine, volume 409, page 814 in 2001, really signals the start of this new era. Dr. Baltimore, the, as you know, president of California Institute of Technology and a Nobel Prize winner himself for his work on reverse transcriptases and in molecular biology, was quoted as saying in his article, "I've seen a lot of exciting biology emerge over the past 40 years, but chills ran down my spine when I first read the paper that described the outline of our genome that now has been published in Nature magazine. Not that many questions are definitively answered by this publication, and for conceptual impact, it does not hold a candle to Watson and Crick's 1953 paper describing the structure of DNA. Nonetheless, it is a seminal paper launching the era of post-genomic science." What have we learned from all these A, G, C's, and T's, he asks. It is important to remember that no statements can be made at this point with high precision as it relates to the genome because the draft sequences have holes and imperfections, and the tools for analysis remain limited. The sequences are about 90% complete for the euchromatic, that's the weakly staining gene-rich regions of the human chromosome. The estimated total size of the genome is about 3.2 gigabases. Of that, about 2.95 gigabases is euchromatic. Only 1.1 to 1.4% is sequence that actually encodes protein. That is just 5% of the 28% of the sequence that is transcribed into RNA. Over half of the DNA consists of repeated sequences of various types, 45% in four classes of parasitic DNA elements that are artifacts from our past history as a hominid, 3% in repeats of just a few bases, and about 5% in recent duplications of large segments of DNA. Dr. Baltimore goes on to say, "I find it striking that most of the parasitic DNA came about by reverse transcription from RNA. In places, the genome looks like a sea of reverse transcribed DNA with small admixture of genes that are mixed in. So much of our genome, therefore, appears to be non-coding for proteins. And the question is, what does that mean? Is it only a relic of a historical archival library of what we have been exposed to in our past evolutionary history, or does it have other functional capabilities yet to be learned? In humans, virtually all the parasitic DNA, which is sometimes called junk DNA, repeats seemingly old and enfeebled with little evidence of continuing reinsertion. However, there has been very little evolutionary scouring of these repeats from the human genome, making it a rich record of our evolutionary past. These artifacts that are stuck within our genes, so-called introns, are made up of largely meaningless, at least as it relates to our present knowledge, sequences that breaks up the protein coding sequence called the exons of our genes. And they're much longer in human DNA than in genomes that have been previously sequenced in other animals and other species of organisms, which may therefore be one of the things that differentiates us from other organisms. What interested Dr. Baltimore most about the genome? The number of genes is high on the list as he looks at things that were surprising. Rather than hundreds of thousands of genes, which were initially expected to be found, the project estimates that there are about 31,000 protein-encoding genes in the human genome. That's the number of coding genes as compared to a sequence of about 6,000 for the yeast cell, 13,000 for the fruit fly, $18,000 for a worm and $26,000 for a plant. So a plant actually has almost the same number of protein encoding genes as does a human. But unless the human genome contains a lot of genes that are opaque to the assessment of today, it is clear that we do not gain our undoubted complexity over worms and plants solely by our numbers of genes. Understanding what does give us our complexity, our enormous behavioral repertoire, ability to produce enormous creativity, conscious actions, physical coordination, precisely tuned alterations in response to various variations in the external environment, learning and memory, all of these remain a challenge that are beyond that of just the number of genes themselves. What do our genes come from? Well, that's a very interesting question. In fact, 94 of the 1,278 protein families in our genome appear to be specific to vertebrates, only 94. The most elementary facets of our cellular function, basic metabolism, transcription of DNA and RNA, translation of RNA into protein, DNA replication, evolved just once and have stayed pretty well fixed, according to Dr. Ballamore, since the evolution of the single-cell yeast and bacterium. The biggest difference between humans and worms or flies is the complexity of our proteins, more domains per protein, more, quote, junk DNA. Interesting question about what the word junk might mean. We wait with bated breath to see the chimpanzee genome, but knowing, according to what Dr. Baltimore says now, how few genes humans have, it's a wonder if we will learn much about the origins of speech, the elaboration of the frontal lobes and the opposable thumb, the advent of the upright posture, or the sources of abstract reasoning ability from a simple genomic comparison of humans and chimps. It seems likely that these features and abilities have mainly come from subtle changes, for example, in gene regulation. Biology today obviously is entering a new era, mainly with a new methodology for answering old questions. Those questions that are some of our deepest and oldest are things like, Daddy, where did I come from? Mommy, why am I different from Sally? As these and other questions get robust answers, biology will become an engine of transformation of our society. Instead of guessing how we differ one from another, we will understand and be able to tailor our life experiences and our medicines to our experience. Much of this may be found to be modifiable on the basis of environmental factors, diet, environment, exercise. We're creating a world in which it will be imperative for each individual person to have sufficient scientific literacy to understand the new riches of this genomic knowledge so we can apply them in a wise fashion. This theme is taken up when we look at the future of this personalized genomic medicine in an article by Dr. Arvinda Chervarta. He goes on to say, it has become clear that the two genomes that each of us carry, inherited from our parents, most often differ from each other and from the genomes of other humans in terms of what are called single base changes, single nucleotide polymorphisms. The 20th century saw the identification of only a few thousand of these so-called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, until the Human Genome Project. Now, there are over 1.4 million of these single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, that have been found. This means that more than 90% of any stretches of a sequence of 20 kilobases long within our DNA will contain one or more of these polymorphisms. These data provide interesting first glimpses into the pattern of biological variation across the genome and are the basis for what Dr. Roger Williams called biochemical individuality 50 years ago. Strikingly, humans vary least in their sex chromosomes, interestingly enough, because they probably have had the least exchange over long lineages of history. Perhaps not surprisingly, some genomic regions have significantly higher diversity than others. One of the most diverse regions of our genome that has the highest numbers of polymorphisms appears to be in the histocompatibility locus antigen region, the region that controls our immune function. These encoding proteins that present antigens to the immune system show the greatest diversity in our genetic background and the most polymorphisms. The main use of human SNP maps will be dissecting the contributions of individual genes to diseases that have a complex multigene basis. Variations in genome sequences underlie differences in our susceptibility or protection from all kinds of diseases, in the age of onset and severity of illness, and in the way our bodies respond to treatment. By comparing patterns and frequencies of single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, in patients and controls, researchers in the future can identify which SNPs are associated with which diseases. Such research will bring about this personalized medicine in which the knowledge of our uniqueness will alter all aspects of medicine perceptibly and forever and make the textbooks we've been studying out of all archaic. Although 82% of SNP variants are found at a frequency of more than 10% in the global human population, the microdistribution of SNPs in individual populations is still not known. By identifying variations across the whole genome, the SNP map may be our best route to better understanding the roles of nature and nurture in controlling our function. An interesting chapter that is starting to be written as the curtain goes back on the new genomic medicine. Now, I want to emphasize that the understanding of SNPs is not where all the action is. The understanding really is better in how these nucleotide polymorphisms are expressed in an individual in different cell lines or tissues or organs. It's the expression patterns and then the conversion of those expression patterns of mRNA into active protein, so-called proteomics. SNPs in and of themselves may only help us to understand a relative risk to disease. It is the genetic expression of those polymorphisms and ultimately the translation to various functional proteins that will determine how they then translate to the phenotype of health or disease. It is this new functional genomic and functional proteomic medicine that is emerging that is putting what I call the ornaments on the branches of Dr. Linus Pauling's molecular medicine and Dr. Roger Williams' biochemical individuality and genotropic disease. This also holds true with regard to the whole way we view the immune system and why some people are susceptible and some people are resistant to certain exposures. There's a wonderful review of this in The Lancet, volume 357, page 2037 in 2001, entitled Immunogenetics and Genomics, in which it's been shown that the analysis of disease susceptibility associated with the HLA, human lymphocyte antigen regions within the DNA, and these variations may have a lot to do with how people are susceptible to various immunologically determined conditions and the translation into diseases like endocrine disorders and autoimmune disease. Pathways for self-tolerance in the treatment of autoimmune disease may therefore likely relate to understanding these SNPs in the HLA region and how to modify the environment to reduce the antigenic exposure or to neutralize the antigen-antibody outcome in the phenotype. That's very nicely described in another companion paper in The Lancet, volume 357, page 2115, entitled Pathways for Self-Tolerance and Treatment of Autoimmune Disease, which for the first time, low zone tolerance conditions and immunization is starting to be understood as the connection between genetic susceptibilities and environmental stimuli and this complex expression in the phenotype of the immune system. This will open up a new form of medicine that I believe will be much more functionally based and incorporate much more of the environment, nutrition, stress, body-mind connections into the technologies and intervention therapies. As an example of that, let's look at Crohn's disease. A very interesting paper was published in the Lancet, volume 357, page 1925 in the year 2001, looking at the association between insertion mutation of what is called the NOD2 gene and Crohn's disease. Genetic predisposition inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, has been shown by epidemiological and linkage studies. And in fact, as you probably recognize from history, there's about a 30-fold increased risk of developing Crohn's disease for an individual who is a sibling of a parent with Crohn's disease. So there certainly has been a reasonably long history of understanding of some genetic component. It appears as if Crohn's may in part be tied to this polymorphism, this SNP of the NOD2 gene, substantially increasing then the susceptibility to Crohn's as a consequence of increased production of tumor necrosis factor alpha in the gut mucosa upon exposure to bacterial cell wall antigens, the so-called bacterial lipopolysaccharides. This may constitute about a fifth of the cases of Crohn's disease, or about 20%, that are attributable to these NOD2 mutations or polymorphisms. That means 80% are associated with other variations and other potential genetic susceptibility factors with other environmental triggering factors. Therefore, the functional medicine model of antecedents, which are locked into our genes and into our SNPs, coupled with triggering factors that are the environmental modifiers that create then mediators, which are the messenger molecules that induce then physiological dysfunction at the cellular and tissue level, which then appear as signs and symptoms, really strikes a new kind of medicine that moves us away from differential diagnosis as a sine qua non to looking at mechanisms of production of disease that comes as a consequence of this mismatch of genes and environment. And I think the Crohn's disease connection to the NOD2 genetic polymorphism is one of a number of examples that are going to emerge in this area. We might even go back to relook at what we talked about last month in Functional Medicine Update, and that's cystic fibrosis. When we talked about the cystic fibrosis transport receptor protein, which is polymorphic in person with cystic fibrosis, and then relates to altered redox potential and changes of mineral transport and water transport, and is modifiable possibly by recognizing that these types of polymorphisms are much more susceptible to oxidative stress, and therefore the critical role that glutathione plays in this particular condition may, and selenium as it relates to the activation of glutathione peroxidase, part of the glutathione recirculating, recycling enzyme system. These are important parts of putting mechanistic understanding behind some clinical observations that have been made over periods of time that maybe glutathione or N-acetylcysteine or selenium were helpful in modifying the signs and symptoms and progression of cystic fibrosis. But because there was no mechanism, no way of rationalizing that observation, it was cast out as being anecdotal. Now we're starting to see the gene-environment connection to mechanism defining this new medicine beyond that, just of the differential diagnosis of cystic fibrosis. And in fact, there may be variant types of cystic fibrosis, some of which are more related to the CFTR protein glutathione connection than others. So one size does not fit all, even within a specific disease type. I'm not talking about this review article on cystic fibrosis from Free Radical Biology and Medicine, Volume 30, page 1440 in the year 2001. And what about statin drugs, which have become a preventive medicine agent for cardiology to lower LDL cholesterol and protect against heart disease? What is the real mechanism by which they operate? Is it solely by that of serving as a HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor and preventing the rate-limiting step for cholesterol synthesis in the liver? Well, it appears now as more work is being done that they have other effects. They may also infect the inflammatory cytokines, which are associated with the increased risk of cardiovascular disease. I'm now talking about the study on pravastatin and its relationship to CRP. This is a paper that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 286, page 64, showing the effect of statin therapy on C-reactive protein levels. This was a prospective trial in which pravastatin reduced CRP levels at both 12 and 24 weeks in a largely LDL cholesterol-independent manner, suggesting that maybe one of the benefits on prevention of heart disease in statin-treated individuals is beyond that of cholesterol reduction itself, but has to do somehow with the inflammatory component of heart disease, the Virchow model that we've discussed at length in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update. And in fact, in the New England Journal of Medicine, Volume 344, page 1959, the year 2001, there's a paper describing the measurement of C-reactive protein for the targeting of statin therapy in the primary prevention of acute coronary events. In this paper, they report the statin therapy may be effective in the primary prevention of coronary events among persons with relatively low lipid levels, but who have elevated levels of CRP as an extended risk factor to heart disease. So it's working by multiple mechanisms, not just as a single agent. And are there other ways of approaching, therefore, the inflammation components of risk to heart disease other than that of statins themselves? And the answer is yes. There's a very nice review in Alternative Medicine Review, Volume 6, page 248, authored by Lynn Patrick and Michael Yuzik, on C-reactive protein and inflammatory disease paradigm utilizing vitamin E, red rice yeast that contains a mixture of natural statin-like compounds, olive oil polyphenols, and how they influence, then, this inflammatory pathway associated with heart disease in a way of attenuating inflammatory mediators. We also know that soy isoflavones themselves lower NF-kappa B and TNF-alpha production in individuals, and therefore the soy association with lowered cardiovascular risk may be more than just the cholesterol association. It may also be the lowering of inflammatory mediators. I'm now talking about a clinical study that was done and published in the Free Radical Biology and Medicine, Volume 30, page 1293, the year 2001, showing that intake of soy has been associated in healthy men with the prevention of expression of NF-kappa B and lowering of TNF-alpha in blood lymphocytes. So there are, again, emerging functional aspects of these interactions, interrelationships that take us beyond pharmacology into looking at how diet and lifestyle and environment have been influencing these gene expression patterns in individuals that then go on to have a phenotype of healthy aging or unhealthy aging. We know that these inflammatory mediators are also cutting across different disease types, not just chronic problems of inflammation of the gut or inflammatory bowel disease, but also talking about cardiovascular disease, cancer, and even diabetes. There's a new paper published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 286, page 327 in 2001, talking about C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, and the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, in which they go on to show that elevated levels of CRP and IL-6 predict the development of type 2 diabetes, supporting a possible role of inflammation in the diabetogenesis. So not only is heart disease and cancer and inflammatory bowel disease, a series of diseases associated with inflammatory mediation, but also type 2 diabetes as well, which may tie together the heart disease risk associated with diabetes. And then we go on from there and say, well, what about atopic dermatitis? Because we know there's a close correlation between atopic dermatitis and insulin-dependent diabetes. Is there something there of an inflammatory nature as well? And do these have to do with similar genetic polymorphisms of inflammatory-prone individuals that are triggered by environmental agents, stress factors, xenobiotics, antigenic agents in the diet? These are very, very complex issues that are creating this new medicine, this what I call functionally based medicine. It's interesting to note, isn't it, that one of the themes that cuts through all of this, other than the inflammatory theme, is the insulin mediation theme and these other hormonal messengers. We're going to talk in this issue about one of the important mediation families, chemical communicating families, which are the thyroid hormones, thyroxine, triiodothyronine, and it's in a relationship with messages to cell function. But insulin certainly plays a central role in this as well, as do the adrenal steroids like cortisol and the sex steroid hormones like estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. Hyperinsulinemia, however, may be a very important link between oxidative stress and age-related diseases. There's a very interesting paper published in Free Radical Medicine Biology, Volume 29. It's a review article talking about this linkage between oxidative stress, hyperinsulinemia, and all age-related diseases, suggesting that inflammation, hyperinsulinemia, and age, I guess you'd call it biological aging, are all interrelated. Hyperinsulinemia could, by its effects on antioxidative enzymes and on free radical generation, enhance oxidative stress. Other pro-aging substances that are associated with the inflammatory process, like increased production of nitric oxide and TNF-alpha and the interleukins, the pro-inflammatory interleukins, may then all work together to create an environment that, based upon that individual's own genetic uniqueness, might appear in one person as heart disease, another person as type 2 diabetes, another person as inflammatory bowel disease, and another person as a metastatic disease or heart disease. So singular mechanisms cut across disciplinary boundaries of disease diagnostic codes. That is a new rule, that's a new tenet that's coming out of the post-genomic medicine that Dr. Baltimore was referring to. So I think that we're in a very, very interesting period of our history in which mechanisms may be more important than naming a disease. Understanding the genetic susceptibility factors, those substances or factors which influence genetic expression, and how that then turns itself into active proteins that control function at the phenotypic level that either promotes healthy aging over decades of living or unhealthy aging due to alarm-like physiology that produces increased cell apoptotic death or damage to tissues, depolymerization of biomolecules like hyaluronic acid, so you get joint-space lubricant loss, you get more friction in the joints, and so forth and so on. So you get all of these affirmities that we associate with aging, which may be associated really with the untoward effects of poor genetic expression, proteomic expression, and then later phenotypic function. Well, that's a long word and a long sentence. What does it really mean to the practicing clinician today? How do we translate this down to something meaningful in the clinic? My answer to that in part relates to how you see the patient. Do you see the patient as solely a differential diagnosis? Is the ICD-9 the whole reason that patient is in the exam room with you? Or is that only part of a picture of a puzzle that you are putting together that describes in your mind antecedents, triggers, mediators that result in signs and symptoms. Are you functionally evaluating that patient in such a way as to understand not just what you call the disease, as Dr. Sidney Baker calls this naming and blaming, but the origin of where that physiological dysfunction has emerged at the phenotype that backed up all the way to the genotype-environment interaction? Understanding single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, is part of the story, but not the whole story. What we really need to know, as I said, is how these SNPs, these susceptibility factors, are converted then into messenger RNA, the gene expression patterns, the amplification of the message by increased transcription and then later translation into active protein at the ribosome. And then the modification of the protein by post-translational effects like phosphorylation, sulfation, oxidation, glycation, that then influence the actual functionality of that finally synthesized protein in changing the phenotype of the cell. This is a very, very powerful type of new insight that really, I think, directs the kinds of questions and the kinds of discovery process that you use in assembling a pattern of information from which a decision can be made, with a focus not solely on the diagnosis, but more on understanding the etiology, the mechanism, the underlying principles that relate to this marriage or interrelationship between antecedent factors and triggering factors. Now, can that give you a different outcome in the way you treat the patient? Or is this just an intellectual interesting area for cerebral exercise? My answer is I think this can lead into an entirely different approach towards the management of the patient by assembling this information, your understanding of the disease, along with the etiology and the mechanism and where the gene-environment connection might exist, because you might find in one patient, if they have an HLA-B27 polymorphism, that for them a certain bacterial symbiont or parasite can be a triggering factor, in this case Klebsiella, for the production of spondyloarthropathies. In another individual, you wouldn't spend your time worrying about, therefore, a gastrointestinal restoration program trying to eliminate Klebsiella as a principal therapeutic intervention because that individual doesn't have the connection between an HLA polymorphism, a specific bacterial cell wall antigen, and the appearance of this inflammatory spondyloarthropathy. So by asking different questions, you can then get to different answers with regard to how that patient is managed. I talked about inflammatory bowel disease and the NOD2 SNP. That constitutes maybe 20% of the patients with IBD. So what would you do? Well, those are individuals that are very susceptible, therefore, to certain bacterial cell wall lipopolysaccharides. So you would really focus, again, the approach on what we call the 4R. Remove, replace, re-inoculate, repair the gut, because the gut connection to its flora may in that individual have a lot to say with regard to how they regulate the expression of those genes that are associated with mRNA that ultimately encodes proteins that are inflammatory mediators like TNF-alpha and IL-1 or IL-6. I hope you're starting to get the drift of where we're going. We're talking also about inflammatory substances like CRP, C-reactive protein, that cut across many different disease diagnostic codes. We're talking about insulin and hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance and glucose transport defects, because there can be many steps along that pathway that may be central features of biological aging that associates itself and maps back against many diseases of aging, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, renal problems, ocular difficulties, cardiovascular disease. And therefore, we're starting to develop, by using these markers, an understanding of the mechanisms of disease that give us a better way of personalizing the medicine to that individual. We haven't even talked, obviously, at length this issue of Functional Medicine Update about pharmacogenomics, which we've talked about in the past, that because of these unique differences in detox enzyme profiles based upon genetic polymorphisms, that certain drugs may be poorly tolerated by certain individuals. If they have a SNP of a cytochrome P450-2D6, they may be much more susceptible to adverse side effects from certain types of SSRI drugs than another individual who doesn't have that polymorphism of 2D6. So we start asking, how does a person respond to specific pharmacological agents in an individual way? This is creating a new medicine, a functional genomic, functional proteomic medicine, that the word functional continues to be the name of the game. Because if we wait to pathophysiology and we just have these broad categories of disease, we are relegated to treating people as averages, knowing that every individual has SNPs that make them unique. We've already said that. And therefore, we're likely to get some unknown or untoward effect in that individual by not asking the questions about their uniqueness. So I think this is the dawn of the new aging. The curtain is coming back. Can you feel this change? Can you feel how it's transitioning with the obituary of managed care as we move into personalized medical care in the 21st century? Well, if you don't understand that, I hope the clinician of the month this month will help you to understand it more in the area of thyroid function. So let's turn to side two for continuation. Well, I know for most of you, this is the most interesting part of our whole functional medicine update each month. That's our clinician of the month section, where it's the kind of news to use, where the tire meets the road clinical expert who speaks with authority as to what actually some of this highfalutin biochemistry and physiology really means in clinical practice from a functional perspective. Once again, we're very pleased today, and I have a particularly great excitement for today because one of my, I guess, compensations for traveling a couple hundred thousand miles a year is I get a chance to meet some very interesting and insightful and innovative people out there in the world that I travel, and certainly today one of those personalities is represented in Dr. Richard Chamas, who is our clinician of the month. Dr. Chamas is a graduate of Harvard College and University of Pennsylvania Medical School. He's a founding member of the American Holistic Medical Association. He had served as an adjunct faculty at the University of California San Francisco Medical Center and had a private practice in Mill Valley, California before relocating with his wife, who is a PhD RN. They relocated to Boca Raton in Florida, where he is now in a general practice, which I would say has, from my perspective, a heavy functional medicine tilt. He and his wife are the authors of a very fascinating new book called Thyroid Power, 10 Steps to Total Health, which I think is a very readable and information content-dense book. And I'd like to introduce Dr. Chamas to you. Richard, thyroid function is often, when we read an endocrinology textbook, said to be very uncommon in clinical practice when we talk about thyroid dysfunction from a thyroid pathology perspective. Yet, from a functional thyroid perspective, according to your book and your clinical experience, it seems much more common. Can you tell us a little bit about how that differentiates itself and how you got more and more interested in this thyroid connection?
Jeff, I would be very happy to do that. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be talking about this particular topic. I believe that there's a tremendous epidemic that is going on. Most people realize it who are not reading a medical textbook. They know that they could ask a pharmacist, what is the most common category of medicines that you write for, that your prescriptions that you fill? And the pharmacist says, oh, that's easy. It's thyroid prescriptions, far and away. Synthroid is certainly one of the second or third largest selling medicines in the country, just that one brand alone. There are several other brands that are popular. It appears that we have a hidden epidemic that has only gotten worse since Protobarans first described this in the 70s with hypothyroid, the unsuspected illness. And it's increasing. The doctors at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York suggest that there could be 20 million Americans currently being treated for thyroid problems. Chester Ridgeway, University of Colorado Health Sciences Center, gave TSH tests to 25,000 people at health fairs in Colorado and found that the incidence and prevalence of the condition is much greater than was suspected. He feels that mild hypothyroidism might be one out of every 10 people in the United States. It goes up to 20% for older women.
When we look at the prevalence of this condition, and I know with Dr. Barnes, one of the ways that he assessed functional thyroid abnormalities was the axillary body temperature test upon wakening. Do you feel that these functional tests or using the acheliometer are ways to get better information than just relying strictly on the blood tests?
Absolutely. As a clinician for 30 years, I have been very troubled with the number of people that come in to see me who have been to other doctors, even endocrinology specialists, and are told, oh, no, your thyroid is fine. And what they mean is that the doctor has done a TSH, maybe done a T4 panel with a T3 uptake and an FTI, and then that's been a normal range, and they're told, oh, you're fine. Even the newer tests with the measurement of the free fraction, the free T4, the free T3, sometimes do not pick up what could be picked up in terms of a possible diagnosis of hypothyroidism with the person who maybe takes their axillary temperature, or that you could have them sit on the table and check a reflex and find that the reflex is hard to elicit. If you can't elicit, it has a very slow recovery rate.
Have you had any experience at all with the acheliometer? I know that that's an instrument that in early stages of assessing thyroid function was found to be very useful, but it seems to kind of fallen out of favor, and I wonder if you've had any experience with it.
I remember it from the early days of my medical training. It was something that I wish I had now. For those who are not familiar with this, it was a machine that did the ankle reflex and printed the result on what was most akin to cardiograph paper, so that you had a curve, and the curve could be very sharp and steep, the curve could be very long and drawn out, the curve could be low or high. All of that was useful information, and clinicians at the time would read that with a great deal of scrutiny and compare it to the blood tests, which sometimes were confirmatory and sometimes not, and they were able to effect an improvement in the patient's function utilizing the reflex test over the blood test.
So when we look at the prevalence that you've described of thyroid-related dysfunctions, it almost starts begging the question as to whether these are causes of illness or they're the effects of other underlying things, because when we get such commonplace difficulties, we often start thinking, well, hold up, is there something else upstream that we should be looking at? What's your feeling about whether this thyroid is the cause or the effect of problems?
Listen, a very, very fine question. I would be delighted if I had better answer about that. The general feeling that I have come to is that for many people, it seems to be primary cause. I believe that part of this epidemic that we're seeing is in large part due to the pollution in the air, food, and water affecting one of the more sensitive of the endocrine glands by way of immune disruption, and that's this autoimmune low thyroid situation. The idea that the other endocrine glands are involved is a possible coincident factor for many people. The primary situation seems to be correctable with attention to the thyroid.
When we look at the nature of the symptoms that a patient presents with, probably most of our clinician listeners are saying, well, I know what to look for in a hypothyroid, functional hypothyroid patient. But just for the sake of reminder, could you take us through some of the more common presenting signs and symptoms?
Absolutely. I just want to be clear as far as the answer to the last question. Frequently, low thyroid situations coexist and commingle with other endocrinopathies. So, of course, when a person has low adrenal, some sex hormone abnormalities, it can present with very similar symptoms. But you try to figure out what you can do. Doing anything anywhere, as far as the functional approach, doing anything anywhere will help everything everywhere. And it's not a linear cause and effect relationship between all these glands. It's a warp and a weave. But I have found for many of my patients in my reading of the literature is that for a great many, there seems to be this primary, if you will, endocrinopathy that's slowing everything else down. And the symptoms of the slowdown: fatigue, depression, overweight, feeling chilly all the time, excess hair loss, dry skin, cracking nails, headaches, low sex drive, high cholesterol, constipation, allergies, unexplained aches and pains, and, oh, Jeff, a long list of female problems. Everything from infertility, endometriosis, miscarriage, bad PMS, or severe menopause. And there's a strong correlation between this hypothyroid condition and the one that you talk about a lot, the polycystic ovary condition, which is related, of course, to other situations, Syndrome X in particular.
I think that was a fantastic list. Obviously, you've thought about that and said that a few times. That flowed pretty quickly off your lips, and we will include all those signs and symptoms on the summary cards for those people that couldn't pick them up off the air.
Well, Jeff, you talk about things like this a great deal. You talk about the biomarkers of aging. The biomarkers of aging in general, or unhealthy aging, reads just like the hypothyroidism list in the textbook. The idea of a person who, say, doesn't have exactly those symptoms I just mentioned, but instead has a general loss of strength or loss of flexibility, or decreased cardiovascular endurance, increased body fat, slower metabolic rate as far as decreased resting energy expenditures, decreased kidney clearance, decreased vibratory sense, altered smell and taste, increased autoantibodies, in this case to the thyroid gland. This is indicative of someone who is either having generalized unhealthy aging, a mixture of the accelerated aging biomarkers, or could simply be a person who has this autoimmune thyroid condition, which appears to be very much on the rise, a favorite target organ for all of the pollution that is coming back to haunt us.
Well, that's a wonderful segue to my next question, because I recall a study that was published in The Lancet about 5 years ago from Italy, looking at the difference between healthy centenarians and unhealthy younger age, I think they were 60 and 70-year-old people, and they were looking for biomarkers that could differentiate these healthy 100-year-old people from the unhealthy younger people. And the one that stood out in that paper, as I recall, were autoantibodies to the endocrine glands with principal the thyroid gland. So it's as if the person who becomes, quote, allergic to their own endocrine glands as they grow older has a more morbid or increased health difficulties than the individual who stays with high vitality throughout their to 100 years of age. So the question then, I guess, as you describe in your book, Thyroid Power, which is a 2001 publication, you describe the fact that the assessment panel should include an autothyroid antibody assessment component as you're looking at how to look at the various functions of the thyroid. So could you tell us a little bit about what you would consider for the clinician to be the panel that might adequately represent, from a clinical chemistry perspective, thyroid function?
Sure. You get to do, in addition to the standard panel, which would be a TSH test alone or a TSH with a free T4. This is the new standard that replaces the TSH with the T4 panel, the old T4 total, T3 uptake, FTI. So now with the TSH and a free T4, you're supposed to be able to diagnose things, but that misses a great many people. So in addition to that, you might get a total T3. I found it very useful, correlates very well with the number of people who seem to have this low thyroid condition, maybe even more so than the free T3. Very useful new test is the free T3. Might be a good part of the testing profile. But absolutely, whatever you do about those, get the thyroid peroxidase antibody and a thyroglobulin antibody. Sometimes it's one, sometimes the other, sometimes both of those are affected.
The peroxidase antibody, for those individuals who may not be remembering some of their basic endocrinology, has to do with the iodinization reaction, the oxidation reduction that produces an available iodine that then ultimately iodinates tyrosine to become eventually thyroxine. So you're talking here about antibodies against both the iodinating component as well as against the component that's related to the function of the gland.
Correct.
And when you examine those, I recall there was a paper published, again, in the Journal of Endocrinology a number of years ago that was authored by Eduardo Gaitan, a professor of medicine at the University of Mississippi School of Medicine, where he showed in a group of individuals in Columbia, South America, who had a very high prevalence in this little village of autoimmune thyroiditis, that it could be attributed back to the contamination of their groundwater, drinking water, with phenols from a chemical processing plant, and that when they cleaned up the water, this idiopathic thyroiditis went away. Do you feel from your experience that there's a pretty close correlation between some of these idiopathic thyroid antibody problems and a body's generalized reaction to xenobiotics?
Absolutely. It's been studied a number of times that these autoimmune conditions seem to exist in extraordinary clusters around toxic waste sites and other places where there have been toxic spill. So if you generalize from that to the population at large and the number of things that people are exposed to, both from the industrial pollution as well as the number of chemicals that we expose ourselves to every day just in our daily life and home and self-care and house cleaning, then you're dealing with what could be an enormous onslaught. So I was particularly moved by, some years ago, the Colburn-Dumanansky project called Our Stolen Future that detailed how we are threatening our whole intelligence, fertility, survival, our health by all of the chemicals that we are trying to have less and less be part of our life, but it's hard to avoid. And then this was really sharpened here more lately. Sheldon Krimsky, a wonderful volume called Hormonal Chaos. And this is a little bit more about what we're discussing, is the environmental endocrine hypothesis. The fact that these chemicals seem to have a direct toxic effect on thyroid tissue, but also have a direct effect on the delicate balance of the immune system. And people who are genetically prone to making autoantibodies, it appears that that maybe 20-25% of the population, the great thyroidologist Lawrence Wood, in his book Your Thyroid, said that maybe 25% of individuals have the unfortunate capacity to make these autoantibodies, the fragments of their own body cells. We're doing more and more of this. Krimsky is just eloquent about what is the scope and nature of the problem. It's enormous. It is an absolutely enormous problem. The EPA was charged with 15,000 of the most common chemicals that are used in products and services in this country to find out which ones are hormonally disruptive. It's mind-boggling.
Well, that leads to another part of the blood panel, because there is a lot of discussion within the field about the role or the value that reverse T3, RT3, has in assessment of thyroid function, and if, in fact, RT3 levels are reflected at all of alterations in enzyme patterns that are impacted by xenobiotic exposure. Do you have any opinions or experience about the value of reverse T3?
Exactly. I would say it is in the same category of the quality of information as the other test for thyroid assessment. If the test is showing a positive finding, you can trust it. You can utilize it. It might be handy information. But if the test is normal, that doesn't mean the problem does not exist. You see what I'm saying? This test, this the reverse T3, as well as the others that we mentioned, as well as every other test that I mentioned in the list of what might be the ideal workup, which could be fairly expensive and therefore is not ideal in that sense. But the tests have many more false negatives than they do false positives. Very few false positives, in fact. So if you have a reverse T3 that's showing an abnormality, you could figure, oh, maybe we've got some difficulty in T4 to T3 conversion. But if you don't see that, you could still be having what appears to be that difficulty. When I say appears to be, because it's often correctable. Sometimes with the person who is taking Synthroid alone, you will add T3 with their Synthroid or their Levoxyl and get quite a bit of improvement. It's startling. It's shocking how many people get tremendous improvement with that little bit of a change, even those people who do not show up with the reverse T3 abnormality.
Well, this is very helpful, because I think what you're describing eloquently is the nature of this web that we've often called the functional web of physiology. Rather than homeostasis, it's homeodynamic. It's constantly changing based upon circadian rhythms, environmental exposures, and so forth. And so what you're really saying to the clinician is you have to develop pattern recognition. You have to look at signs, you have to look at symptoms, you have to look at the blood tests, and you put all these things together, the axillary body temperature test, the Achilles reflex signs that the patient has, and from that develops a pattern that leads you then into your clinical judgment, rather than putting your eggs in one diagnostic basket.
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the steps. Our book is Thyroid Power. It's called 10 Steps to Total Health. One of the steps is step four. It says, realize you may still be low thyroid despite normal tests. And that goes to what we were talking about before. The standard thyroid tests have a disturbingly high rate of false negatives. Okay, but realizing you could still be low thyroid with normal tests is for a person who might have come to your office who's been told, oh, I was checked for my thyroid and it's been fine, except my sister has low thyroid, my mother has low thyroid, my grandmother has low thyroid, and I have this whole long laundry list of low thyroid symptoms. But the test doesn't show that. Well, you could still have it even with the normal test. And similarly, a person who's been on Levoxyl for some time and now has TSH fairly normalized but has not regained full function. And this is what I love about functional medicine. We talk about it's the lab test. The person has to be feeling better, has to have some improvement in a variety of the symptoms, that whole symptom list that we just mentioned, in addition to their overall total vitality. If they don't have that, okay, then regardless of what the tests are showing, you could have a problem. Now, that's just one of the 10 steps. Let me mention a few of the others, okay?
Before we do that, I'd like to ask one quick question, because I do want to get in now to the clinical management side, which you've done beautifully in your book. I think it's just an eloquent description and very understandable to the both clinician and to their patient. But one of the questions that I know may be on the mind of some of our listeners is, what are my medical legal risks if I was to assess thyroid function by this complex web and come to the conclusion that thyroid support was called for? And one of my colleagues who doesn't understand this would then say, well, you know, there was no evidence of hypothyroidism and you're over-treating. I know there's been a couple of medical legal concerns in the country that have been raised with doctors who have treated functional thyroid problems. Do you have an opinion about that concern?
Sure. Listen, we had for many years a TSH range that was considered the normal, 0.5 to 5.5, say, was a normal range. And that range had actually come down from, I remember time, it was a TSH of 7.5 was still considered normal. So like the cholesterol ranges, that range has come down. And just recently, I believe it's American College of Clinical Endocrinologists and National Endocrine Society, came out with a statement that, oh, we realize that for almost 20 years we've been insisting that this is the normal range, but now we've decided that the range would be 0.5 to 3.0, so a much more narrow range. The medical legal concerns regarding using just these tests that most people realize are not adequate for the job, I believe is relatively small. There's more and more information that's going out. In fact, Ridya Aram, MD, is one of the professors of endocrinology at Baylor, wrote a wonderful book called The Thyroid Solution. And in it he said, even if the TSH is in the lower end of the normal range, quote unquote, the desirable, right, you could still be borderline hypothyroid. More and more endocrinology people are insisting that we need to broaden our view on this. I believe that the medical legal risk is relatively small if you have and are able to document a variety of other factors. There's all of the symptoms that we just mentioned, the signs that you could get from just a regular physical exam, the reflex that we talked about, of course, the low skin temperature, lack of body hair or changes in terms of lowered blood pressure. You might have a high cholesterol with fairly good dietary intake. There's a number of other factors. The family history can be very compelling, associated illnesses, and if you have a low basal temperature. Although conventional doctors are not fond of using that, it can be quite compelling along with all of this other data. So if you base your diagnosis not just on one laboratory value, but on signs, symptoms, family history, associated illness, metabolic rate in terms of the axillary temperature, you have pretty good footing for considering a functional intervention.
Yeah, I think that's really beautifully said. That takes us then to what this functional intervention might be. And again, this 10 steps to total health in your book, Thyroid Power, really does a very nice job. It's almost a checklist. Can you kind of guide us through that 10 steps?
Sure. The first step, consider thyroid a hidden factor in the patient's overall health. Just be aware of it. The rationale is that more and more studies are suggesting a surprisingly high incidence of borderline hypothyroidism, which can cause symptoms in itself or can exacerbate other symptoms. And that leads into step two, which is learn how low thyroid can make any other illness worse. The rationale, coexistent subclinical hypothyroidism often exacerbates other disease symptomatology. A person with arthritis, sometimes rheumatoid, sometimes osteoarthritis, can be having much less of a problem and need much less medicine if a coexistent hypothyroidism is treated well. Step three, we already talked about a little bit, use signs, symptoms, and family history to support a diagnosis. Accurate diagnosis of mild hypothyroidism requires a detailed history and a high index of clinical suspicion and a good physical exam, looking for these possibilities. Step four we talked about, but it's worth repeating because this is really one of the heart of the matter. Realize you may still be low thyroid despite normal tests, whether it's diagnosing someone de novo for the first time or whether it's to see if a person who's been on thyroid intervention for some years is at the proper optimal intervention. The standard thyroid tests have disturbingly high rate of false negatives. Step 5, discover the best dose, brand, or mix of medicines, because no single method of thyroid treatment is optimal for all patients. Jeff, this is what you have talked about over and over, genotype uniqueness. A person who may have the family trait for autoimmune glandular disease, or especially autoimmune thyroid. And people who have diabetes in the family, or rheumatoid arthritis, that is certainly enough of a family history to call this one. The idea of being on just one medicine, or finding just the right medicine, is now giving way to the idea of what is the proper mix of medicines. Sometimes the mix is not just the T3-T4 combo, but the T3-T4 combo along with natural desiccated thyroid, all right? And there's more about the mix later, we'll talk. But step 6 is to know that you can get further improvement by rebalancing the reproductive system. This last year, Jeff, I know you were involved in a number of seminars regarding the female hormone balance, the intricacies of that. It turns out rebalancing the reproductive system, for women it might mean some progesterone added. For men, maybe a small amount of testosterone. Not necessarily for the symptoms of a lack of those, but instead doing so will improve the thyroid condition that you're trying to treat. Now, number step 7 is a little harder. This is terminus low adrenal should also be treated. Adverse hormonal effects of autoimmune situations can include low function of the adrenal as well as thyroid tissue. Hypofunction of adrenal tissue due to autoimmunity is perhaps as unrecognized, given little credit, as the low-functioning thyroid due to autoimmunity. It's a very important factor. It's much more common than we realize, and it's much more difficult to test for. We know the difficulties of the thyroid test, as we've just been discussing. The difficulties encountered with adrenal testing are much greater because of the time of day that's involved and the quality of the test. Some of the newer tests might be a little bit better. The idea of measuring 4 separate samples of urine or 4 separate samples of saliva for getting an adrenal stress index might be very useful, might be more useful than some of the standard blood tests. But the adrenal situation is very difficult. Long before you would have abnormalities there on any of those tests, you would have low adrenal reserve. So the possibility of checking for that with the ACTH stimulation test, that might be a very useful maneuver. However, it needs to be interpreted a little more generously than is the standard interpretations. The same thing true if you have total negative normal results on your thyroid test, the panel that we just mentioned. You can do a TRH test, very similar to this ACTH stimulation test. For the adrenal, you could do that TRH test for the thyroid. And that is supposed to be the gold standard. And still, it's just one test. So the same thing for this adrenal test. I don't know how much faith you can put in any one test. It's a whole picture. But whatever you come up with, the step 8 is you can boost whatever medication protocol the person is on or that you put the person is on with natural therapies, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, all of that very crucial to thyroid function. Perhaps the most crucial aspect for thyroid would be the antioxidants. Now, Jeff, you're certainly fond of the antioxidant approach for other endocrinopathies, and be similar for the thyroid. High doses of ACE, CoQ10, lipoic acid, N-acetylcysteine, carnitine, quercetin. These, very helpful, and why? Well, we're dealing with thyroid inflammation. Thyroiditis, autoimmune thyroiditis, is an inflammatory condition, and not just of the thyroid tissue. So all of the normalization that we're very fond of with functional medicine, all of the diet and nutritional tailoring that we can apply, the nutrient enhancement, all of that, very helpful for thyroid sufferers. Exercise training, stress management, promotion of structural integrity, all of that is crucial. Counseling for purposeful living, environmental adjustment. All of those go along with what you're trying to do is normalized the intracellular and intercellular communication by enhancing what could be low thyroid hormone. Step 9, improve the underlying autoimmune condition. How many people do that? We in functional medicine do a lot of that. Generally, conventional medicine tries to get off with saying, look, we will give thyroid hormone if a lowered TSH results in less stimulation of the thyroid gland as a factory producing thyroid hormone, then we have less of the likelihood of the autoantibody situation getting worse and worse. So a low TSH, less autoimmunity. Sometimes you can even measure the antibodies as a barometer. But sometimes the antibodies will not come down even though the person improves. So any one of these tests to be used as a barometer is befraught with difficulties. If it works, use it. It's very handy to show other clinicians and to the patient that their thyroid peroxidase antibody is less now that they have embarked on treatment, that they're feeling better, their basal temperatures are improved, more stamina, more life vitality. That's great. Keep doing it. But there are other ways of improving the underlying autoimmune condition that is just the part and parcel of the functional medicine that, Jeff, that you've been talking about for a number of years now. Now, step 10, reach optimal recovery with an empowered lifestyle. The chances of optimal recovery are greatly improved with healthy lifestyle behaviors. Caffeine, alcohol, tobacco, sugar, salt, things that people get involved in terms of risky behaviors, they're very risky for thyroid recovery. So as much of the proper kind of counseling that you can do and the stress reduction activities that you can encourage, all of that would be helpful for optimal thyroid recovery program. So, Jeff, there it is, 10 steps, and sometimes you don't have to take them in that order. Sometimes the thyroid is not the main event, and I don't mean to say that I think it's the main event all the time or most of the time. It's just that in a significant percentage of people, it is apparently much more the main event than we thought. It's the throttle for all the other organs and for all the other chemical reactions that we're trying to encourage. Sometimes it's the sine qua non. So try to isolate, figure out which people that is, and then work with these steps.
Well, I want to really compliment you. You have done a very, very good job in compressing a tremendous amount of information in a short period of time. Your book, I think, also does that in obviously a slightly more elaborate way, but you have a tremendous reference list at the back of the book. You've got a lot of facts. You've got the summaries of your 10-step programs, and a good rhetoric that underlies the logic of this whole approach, I think, is very compelling. So I want to compliment you. This is taking a vast amount of your clinical experience and weaving together the conventional with the, I would say, the body-mind functional approach in a way that really makes sense. And obviously from your experience that you describe a number of case histories in the book, you've had some very remarkable recoveries in people who had these mysterious chronic illnesses that were just lingering.
Exactly. It's worth considering that there are some people who seem to have this particular endocrinopathy, even though they might have polyendocrinopathies, okay? This particular condition might be eclipsing a variety of other things because it is just some way more fundamental and more basic that if you don't have thyroid hormone, you can't do a lot of the other things that you're trying to accomplish in a functional approach. Millions of people are suffering needlessly from this, and oddly enough, I mean, this is one of those conditions that this current debate about what would constitute a true diagnosis of hypothyroidism that is really missing the point. We're dealing with a situation that needs a dysfunctional perspective so that you can get some earlier intervention. You can do a diet and lifestyle modification, and you can use vitamins, minerals, and herbal preparations, intervene on this condition long before there is this pathology. Why wait until, as conventional medicine would say, you have definite pathology and you have definite organ shutdown before treating what could be a condition that is going to cause enormous problems everywhere? I think millions of people are suffering needlessly if we could just look at this in a slightly different way.
Well, I think you really helped us to see it in that different way. And Dr. Chalmers, I want to really, again, thank you, because I believe this topic and the way you've described it fits so nicely into this whole healthy aging focus that we have on functional medicine this past year, and gets us to think in broader constructs of the web of interaction of the sex steroid hormones with the adrenal function, with the hypothalamus and pituitary function, and with the thyroid, and how that controls basal metabolic rate and other functions within tissues and cell physiology that gives rise to these complex symptoms. And often we're looking for the magic bullet, when the bullet is really the understanding of the approach, more than just the single medicine or the single lab test.
Absolutely. For the very difficult and complex patients, just keep this in mind as a possibility, because it can be very helpful.
Well, thank you very much. And again, Thyroid Power, 10 Steps to Total Health, Dr. Richard Chalmers and his wife, Carrie Lee Halo Chalmers, a very well-done book, and something that I think can make a contribution to opening up this topic towards remediation. Wish you the best, and we'll be in touch with you real soon.
Always a pleasure, Jeff.
Thanks so much. One of the principles that Dr. Chalmers describes in his discussion of thyroid function and its relationship to other factors in regulatory control is the interrelationship between adrenal hormones and sex steroid hormones, a very important clinical pearl that I think deserves comment, particularly in light of a recent paper that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, a paper by Arafa, talking about the increased need for thyroxine in women with hypothyroidism during estrogen therapy. This appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 344, page 1743 in 2001. The Arafa study was 11 postmenopausal women with normal thyroid function and 25 postmenopausal women with hypothyroidism that were being treated with thyroxine. Thyroid function was assessed before they started estrogen therapy and every 6 weeks for 48 weeks thereafter. The women with hypothyroidism included 18 women receiving thyroxine replacement therapy and 7 women receiving thyrotropin suppressive thyroxine therapy. On each occasion, serum thyroxine, free thyroxine, thyrotropin, and thyroxine-binding globulin were measured. The conclusion of the study is quite interesting. It was found that in women with hypothyroidism, treatment with thyroxine and estrogen therapy increased the need for thyroxine. And as we know, there may be many women who are demonstrating symptoms of functional hypothyroidism for whom they're getting some degree of thyroid replacement, and may also be getting a hormone replacement, sex steroid hormone replacement of estrogen by mouth. So I think that this data indicating that some women with hypothyroidism receiving thyroxine therapy need more thyroxine, this is a change caused by estrogen-induced increase in the serum concentration of thyroxine-binding globulin. This increased need for thyroxine occurs in women with hypothyroidism who were receiving moderate doses of thyroxine intended to replace normal thyroxine secretion. Thyroxine-binding globulin, as you know, is a glycoprotein produced by the liver that binds thyroxine with high affinity. About 75% of the thyroxine in the blood serum is bound to it. Nearly all the rest is bound to albumin, with less than 0.1% remaining free or unbound. The physiological function of thyroxine-binding globulin is not known, but it may serve to distribute thyroxine evenly among the tissues, particularly the liver. Serum concentrations of thyroxine-binding globulin are similar in men and women, indicating postmenopausal women that the production is not affected by the different rates of estrogen production in normal men and younger and older women. However, if a woman is treated orally with 0.625 milligrams of conjugated estrogens daily, which raise serum thyroxine-binding globulin concentrations by approximately 50%, in both the women with normal thyroid function and those with hypothyroidism, then we start concerning about an adverse impact of estrogen replacement therapy on thyroid hormones in the hypothyroid women. The estrogen-induced effects increase the serum thyroxine-binding globulin concentrations in a dose-dependent fashion, and it occurred with any orally administered estrogen, whether given alone or in combination with a progestin, and even in the form of an oral contraceptive, or in combination with medroxyprogesterone in postmenopausal women. Serum thyroxine-binding globulin concentrations also increase in women treated with tamoxifen or raloxifene, the new, as you know, selective estrogen receptor-modifying drugs, the SERMs, but this is less potent than the standard estrogens themselves. Transdermal estradiol therapy, however, does not raise serum thyroxine-binding globulin concentration. This suggests then that the oral administration, which has a different effect on first-pass liver function, may then contribute to the higher levels of estrogen in the portal vein, and therefore what we start seeing is oral effects, not transdermal effects, in this estrogen-thyroxine connection. it may be suspected that women treated with thyroxine in whom estrogen therapy has begun might need more thyroxine. In pregnant women, serum thyroxine-binding globulin increases to the same extent as they do in women treated with 0.625 milligrams of conjugated estrogens per day, and they also lose some thyroxine to their fetuses, and as a result of the placental deionization of thyroxine to reverse T3, this becomes a biologically inactive form of thyroid hormone. As a result of these changes, women with hypothyroidism who are being treated with thyroxine need approximately 50% more thyroxine when they're pregnant, according to this study. Conversely, women with hypothyroidism treated with thyroxine need lower doses of thyroxine when they're treated with androgens, which lower the serum thyroxine binding concentration, the other side, the yin and yang of this. So androgen-supplemented women, lower need for thyroid hormones. Estrogen oral-treated women, increased need for thyroid hormone. Many women are obviously taking estrogen either for contraception or to ameliorate menopausal symptoms or other manifestations of estrogen deficiency, and many women are also on thyroid replacement therapy, and therefore I think it's very important to see that these things have part of the orchestrated dance together, and one needs to be very cautious about balancing the levels of thyroid hormones against the sex steroid hormones, particularly the androgens and estrogens, as is indicated by this recent article by Dr. Arafat. I think, again, this is a nice indication of the balance, the dance, the rhythm of the functional physiology, this homeodynamic orchestration that we're describing. Although this might look like a more complex medicine to get one's arm around, it's a medicine that has a lot more exciting variegations and a lot more what I would call topography for creating an environment for that patient of high treatment successful outcome. And that's really the whole nature of what the new medicine of the 21st century post-genomic era is all about. So I hope that you got some news to use from this month and the wonderful discussion clinically about hypothyroidism from Dr. Seamus and how that fits into this whole construct of the web of our genomes, our single nucleotide polymorphisms, our multigene expression patterns, and later our phenotype that we experience as we age. We'll talk with you in November.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, Incorporated, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.